To state it plainly, Bitcoin is a momentous monetary innovation, enabling a new mode of non-nation-state human organization, a purified form of capitalism, free of nation-state interference and deserving of its own neologism. Let us call the new mode of socioeconomic organization, enabled by encrypted digital money, sovereignism. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are getting into a great series today. I don't know if we're going to be able to do the whole series, but this is part one of a new series by Robert Breedlove, and it is on the Swan Bitcoin blog. I've been meaning to get to this one for a while and slowly piecing it together. But it is all about the sovereign individual thesis and laying out the fundamentals, the dynamics that have changed with the existence of a digital money, an encrypted form of value, and how this could potentially destroy or drastically changes the economic cost and reward reality of a centralized, violent institution of governance. Of the nation state as we know it today. And what does that mean for our future? And we are reading this one today. It's a great one. But before we get into it, I want to thank our sponsor, who is also Swan Bitcoin, who not only have a great blog with a ton of pieces that I love reading, but also they have an automated, simple, no hassle, set it and forget it Bitcoin savings plan. And the lowest cost one out there. Stacking sats automatically is the way to stack sats. Check them out at swanbitcoin.com/guy. And then our other wonderful sponsor, creators of the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet from Shift Crypto. They've just got an awesome, sleek, simple to use and easy to set up hardware wallet that is open source and secure. And on their store, they've also got a lot of other great backup and security devices like tamper-evident bags, metal seed storage, and things like that. So check them out at guyswan.com/bitbox. And with that, let's get into the read by Robert Breedlove, and it's titled Sovereignism Part 1, Digital Creative Destruction by Robert Breedlove. A 12-part essay series exploring the digital disruption of the nation-state and the subsequent amplification of individual sovereignty during the digital age. This series is based on the 1997 masterwork, The Sovereign Individual. Digital Creative Destruction. Technology is advancing much faster than our ability to understand its implications. Ken Goldstein. Statism is a system of socioeconomic organization which originated in the industrial age. Statism includes all state implementations of capitalism, communism, fascism, and all other state isms. It does not refer to these ideologies in any pure sense. Statist implementations arose in the 20th century, when the only known mode of sustainable human organization was a top-down, centrally controlled nation-state. Like feudalism before it, which fell to the Gutenberg printing press, statism has fallen behind the technological realities of its era. In the 21st century, digitization is devouring every inefficient technological implementation, from media to dating to advertising and travel. In the sphere of statism, digital tools are antiquating analog nation-states by radically empowering individuals in novel and profound ways. All states are shaped by technology. Mankind exists in continual pursuit of more energy-efficient modes of self-organization. To preserve the productivity liberated by the division of labor, while minimizing expenditures necessary for security. This is the purpose of society. By subdividing labor ever more deeply, mankind's global treasury of knowledge grows ever richer, informing the development of better tools and systems. As man has achieved more decentralized modes of securing property and persons, new states have emerged. The world has endured a long progression from tyranny of ancient Egypt to the representative democracies of Western civilization. In succession with these socioeconomic, quote, phase changes, vast amounts of creative energy are freed in the form of productivity, profits, and capital accumulation. Optimizing for individual choice is the most energy-efficient strategy for socioeconomic organization. Capitalism outcompeted communism, destroying the USSR in the process for this reason. Voluntarily adopted rules, free markets, do not incur the same enforcement and security costs as systems with imposed rules, unfree markets. Capitalism triumphing over communism is the classic Schumpeterian process of creative destruction, where innovation obsoletes older and less energy-efficient tools and systems, liberating energy for allocation to other aims. Tremendous economic returns emerge in the wake of this destructive yet creative process. Consider, for instance, that 84 times more man-hours, human energy, were necessary to construct the Great Pyramid of Giza than the Burj Khalifa skyscraper in Dubai. Yet due to the knowledge specialization of modernity, the Burj stands at a staggering 830 meters, 7 times as tall as the ancient pyramid. A spectacular testament to modern, albeit marginalized, capitalism, the Burj Khalifa was constructed orders of magnitude more efficiently than the Great Pyramid of Giza, 498 times taller per man-hour. As a socioeconomic system, capitalism allocates energy more intelligently than communism. Organizational well-being is maximized when individual sovereignty is prioritized. Capitalism did this well, but was hampered by state intervention in the monetary and legal spheres. Even more deeply rooted in free market principles, sovereignism promises to be an unrivaled allocator of energy toward the higher satisfaction of human wants. Energy is truth. If you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of frequency, vibration, and energy. Nikola Tesla. Harnessing energy for self-generation is the aim of all life. Energy is more efficiently converted to mechanical work in strongly bonded systems. In physical systems, these bonds are molecular. In economic systems, these bonds are property. Stronger bonds equal greater energy efficiency. Considerations of energy efficiency shape the tools and systems mankind creates for himself. Thermodynamically sound structures, those which maximize the utility of absolutely scarce energy, tend to become favored in free market competition. Stronger bonds translate into higher power capacity, the ability to retain energy over time without dissipation. In a universe where life continuously competes for its share of finite energy, profligacy is ruinous. As the most accurate portrayal of reality, energy is truth. Conservation of energy, then, is conservation of truth, the key to success in competitive conditions for organisms and organizations alike. Trade and money are foundational to socioeconomic organization. People exchange their energy to produce the fruits of labor. Money is the medium through which people trade energy. Ideally, money is as scarce as the energy necessary to produce the fruits of labor, to which it lays claims. As the base layer operating system of human cooperation, this thermodynamically sound money would have profound implications on the socioeconomic systems it upholds. Such a monetary medium would need to be as agnostic to political machinations and criminal actions as the thermodynamic reality of absolute energy scarcity it securitizes. Stopping the allocation of human energy into management of, more accurately, politicking over the power to manage, the money supply, mankind liberates his energies to construct more robust socioeconomic structures on the unshakable foundation of immutable money. Quote, war is the continuation of politics by other means. Clausewitz. Thermodynamically sound money would establish a neutral territory where all that matters is how much you can contribute to the productivity of society. Military rank, political affiliation, and proximity to the printing press as determinants of position in the global wealth hierarchy would be largely eliminated. By giving society a source of indisputable truth around which it can self-organize, much violence in the world would be disincentivized and defunded. When rules can't be bent and money can't be easily confiscated through political measures, the pursuit of peaceful cooperation becomes the most productive strategy. Immutable money innervates politics and its Clausewitzian continuation, warfare. Sovereignism rises. All human rights may be distilled into one: choice. As you may have guessed by now, this ideal, thermodynamically sound, and apolitical money is Bitcoin. As a 12-year-old digital disruptor to one of the most ancient and important tools in the world, gold, Bitcoin is a tectonic shift in human organization. Gold is the 5,000-year-old base layer monetary operating system for all modern systems of human governance, an ancient sovereignty system that has been corrupted by central banking. Breaking the centralized stranglehold on money by disrupting it at the base layer, Bitcoin enforces a total revamping of the socioeconomic systems derived from money, including the rule of law, private property rights, and various institutional forms. Nobody knows what shape this megapolitical transition will take, but it will certainly be an organic bottom-up emergence, since top-down control over this paradigmatically new sovereignty system simply does not exist. To state it plainly, Bitcoin is a momentous monetary innovation enabling a new mode of a non-nation-state human organization. A, quote, purified form of capitalism, free of nation-state interference and deserving of its own neologism. Let us call the new mode of socioeconomic organization enabled by encrypted digital money, sovereignism. To fully explore the implications of sovereignism, let's begin with the inviolable first principle of socioeconomics. Man must act. Action requires energy and implies purpose, as all conscious decision-making involves the attempted achievement of an aim. The aims of man are always toward the alleviation of anxiety, what Austrian economists call want satisfaction or reduced uneasiness. Mankind is the dominant species on Earth because he uses technologies and organizational systems to channel energy across space-time with more intelligence and toward more profound purposes than any other animal. Our higher aims require the channeling of energy at larger spatio-temporal scales, and with more sophistication, and with greater precision. Used properly, technologies and socioeconomic systems help us alleviate anxieties more easily. Tools amplify the force of our work efforts, increasing the ratio of outcomes to energy expended. Systems of socioeconomic organization, like capitalism, socialism, and now sovereignism, let us engage in concerted action to intensify collective output through the concentration of individual attention on ever narrower phases of production, the productivity gains resulting from the division of labor. In this sense, tools are organizations, and organizations are tools. Both are useful for enhancing the overarching purpose of human life, the execution of action aimed at anxiety alleviation. The tools an organization's best fit for energy conservation win over time. Tools and organizations are both means for more intelligently channeling energy across space-time. The hydroelectric dam and the nation-state have this in common. They are both intelligently designed reservoirs and allocators of energy. The dam for hydroelectric energy of water, and the nation-state for the metabolic, political, and productive energy of populations. Both, at least temporarily, harness and channel the entropic onslaught of ecological and human nature. But in the end, both give way to the decentralizing tendencies of the very nature they seek to contain. Water always flows to the lowest places, and people always self-organize in ways that most favor their economic interests. The ultimate man-made tools for decentralizing power away from the top-down institutional control are open-source digital organizations, like those composing the many layers of the Internet Protocol suite. WikiLeaks, the Arab Spring, the George Floyd protests are just a few examples proving the Internet poses a major threat to centralized power structures. Social movements like this are mere tremors of the coming nation-state collapse. As the only non-state digital money, Bitcoin is the value layer of the Internet, the first viable competitor to the sovereignty system gold provided historically. An extension of the self-organizing internet ecosystem, Bitcoin is the world's first self-sovereign digital organization. These organizational forms are the most advanced way of harmonizing individual and collective willpower. A self-sovereign digital organization, like Bitcoin, is self-governing and can split in the event political differences threaten organizational cohesion, see the Bitcoin Cash fork. As an intrinsically more adaptive, fluid, and volitional system for allocating socioeconomic energy across space-time, Bitcoin outcompetes the closed source, analog, and compulsory organization of nation-states. Bitcoin is an indisputable sovereignty system reconciling individual exchanges made within the socioeconomic collective. It obviates the need for nation-states and exists with absolute agnosticism to the man-made systems of law and order which incubated it during its early years. Leveraging the power of human nature and incentives as two of its indispensable operating components, Bitcoin harnesses human energy to scale its network. As a loss-minimized system for storing and transferring the fruits of labor, Bitcoin's fixed money supply generates its own demand, validating Say's law as ever more wealth is plundered via inflation. This is why everyone ends up on Bitcoin's payroll eventually. A new breed of global citizen is now emerging. Inhabitants whose influence, voice, and capital can completely transcend locality and its various local authorities. Compulsion finally cedes to civilization as sovereignism rises. Free market governance. Microprocessing will subvert and destroy the nation-state, the sovereign individual. Sovereignism succeeds by reducing the economic returns traditionally associated with violence and coercion. Citizens will demand contract law and property assurances of equal integrity to those offered by Bitcoin. Otherwise, they will not part with their money. In the same way, summoning a stranger to be your private driver for the evening would seem crazy 25 years ago, digital technology will continue to change the nature of trust and human interaction. But when money digitizes, the implications are much more significant. Multi-signature capabilities of Bitcoin are already being explored as a means for facilitating private contract governance independent of state courts. This has the potential of growing into a decentralized alternative to the traditional justice system. since money can no longer be censored or stolen. The socioeconomic structures developed atop this base layer operating system will leverage encryption to strive for an equivalent censorship resistance. But like all new births, the transition to this decentralized state of unparalleled civilization is bound to be messy. When the economic returns of organizing violence at scale decline, the business models premised on protection from violence, governments and nation-states, necessarily shrink and become more localized. This macroeconomic counterswing of the pendulum means violence will become more small-scale and randomized, akin to what prevailed in the truly decentralized age of hunters and gatherers. Like paleo diets, yoga, meditation, Ayurvedic medicine, entheogens, and even Bitcoin, which is Austrian economic money, sovereignism is yet another example of how ancient ways are resurgent in the digital age. As surely as capitalism outcompeted communism, sovereignism will outcompete statism in all its forms. By empowering individual freedom in radically new ways, societies adhering to organizational principles consistent with sovereignism, broad industrial privatization, de-bureaucratization, consensual taxation, Bitcoin, etc., will generate more wealth than the command and control economies of more rigid nation-states and attract more citizens. More competitive jurisdictions mean less tolerance for bureaucratic wastefulness. As citizens wake up to this new reality, the modern obsession with state politics will fade into a relic of a bygone era. Contrary to modern misconceptions, economics drives politics. Politics do not drive economics. The legislator's pen does not create wealth. It can only distribute it. As political bureaucracies swell to the point of being unsustainable by their underlying productive economies, desperation will cause government overreach to explode, forcing market actors to shelter wealth any way they can. And in the 21st century, capital will find no more unassailable domain than the digital. As capital flees into the digital domain to escape escalating taxation and inflation, government revenues will fall rapidly, causing them to fragment and fail. As a result, organized crime is likely to grow in scope during this transition. In truth, the nation-state is organized crime, the apparatus of compulsion and coercion intended to insulate the productivity gains generated by a peaceful division of labor. Legal and police systems protect market actors from endogenous threats to the economic wellspring of free trade, while the military neutralizes exogenous threats. The nation-state was 20th century society's best way of wielding violence to preserve peace. But the technological realities of the 21st century significantly change the calculus of violence. Since digital capital cannot be unilaterally seized via taxation or inflation, the level of protection services nation-states actually provide will come to reflect their true production costs over time. Said differently, in the digital age, nation-states will be forced to compete and earn the loyalty of their citizens, like any other free market enterprise, and will therefore only be able to charge market rates for their decreasingly necessary services. Traditional legal and police systems required for enforcing contract law, preserving property rights, and peacekeeping in the industrial age may quickly find themselves facing irrelevance in a world where these services are more efficiently provided by self-organizing digital networks. Coupled with the collapsing tax capacities of governments, many former state-provided services will fall to software. All right, we're about halfway through at the section Digital Darwinism. Let's take a quick break for our sponsor and we will jump right back in. Swan Bitcoin is where it's at. Bitcoin goes up and you get euphoric and you get a FOMO in. Bitcoin goes down, you're going to panic and sell. Then Bitcoin's kind of going sideways and you're like nervous. I don't know what to do. Is this a top? And then it skyrockets up and now you buy it all the way back at the very top and it goes all the way back down again and you panic. Stop doing this to yourself. If you dollar cost average, if you automatically buy Bitcoin on a regular basis, just like me, you'll buy the dip, the climb, the sideways, the climb, and the dip. And it will be stress-free and you will just keep getting more sats. And you don't have to babysit anything. Auto buy and auto withdraw to your own hardware wallet for the long term. It is a simple Bitcoin savings plan. Check them out at swanbitcoin.com/guide. That is my referral, and it will get you some free sats when you start your plan. It is not the automated Bitcoin savings plan you deserve. It's the one you need. SwanBitcoin.com/guy. Digital Darwinism. Efficiency will become more important than the dictates of power in the organization of social institutions. The sovereign individual. As nation states falter, barriers to market entry, participation, and exit will fall too, thereby exacerbating free market competition and wealth generation. In digitally enabled, hyper-competitive marketplaces, power law distributions predominate and winner-take-all effects proliferate. Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Microsoft, and now Bitcoin are all examples of this Darwinian digital paradigm. Choice and experimentation will become the defining variables of redefining socioeconomic organization. New modes of securing life, liberty, and property will be tried, failed, and iterated upon. The ever-present threat of capital flight into unreachable digital space will force institutions wishing to survive to deal with citizens honestly. When governments are dematerialized by software, they will become almost unrecognizably agile, innovative, and fragmentary. Encryption embroils nation-states in digital acid, dissolving each of their most rigid power structures and transforming their incentive structures from within. Only the most productive and accountable governmental functions will remain. With the restrictions of locality largely diminished, only the most valuable services will earn customer capital and attention. Meritocracy supplanting bureaucracy is distinctive to sovereignism. Digitization makes results matter more than decrees, meaning merit will ascend the social hierarchy of values. A world in which all spatio-temporal bounds are lifted will become an age of excellence. For instance, it is already no longer good enough to be the best cover band in your city. Thanks to YouTube, you now need to be the best cover band in the world and across all time to compete successfully for the attention of your target audience. Cover bands must even compete with the original band they're covering in an era defined by digital media. When sales demonstrations are conducted over digital media instead of in person, executives will deploy only their most adept salespeople no matter where they live. Minimized bureaucratic barriers will maximize the promotion of merit and mitigate political forcefulness in business. With less to be gained from the use of force, efficiency becomes more important than magnitude in terms of channeling energy across space-time. When effectiveness trumps fiat in this way, institutions disintegrate and reorganize, with the resultant economic gains largely accreting to the, quote, cognitive elite, who successfully presage and prepare for the mega-political shifts underfoot. Those who synchronize their affairs to adapt to this fluid, borderless, and self-organizing digital zeitgeist, largely by being among the first to move their savings into Bitcoin and diversify their citizenship options, will dethrone the, quote, ruthless capitalists of the industrial age to crown themselves the, quote, sophisticated sovereignists of the digital age. Digital technology broadens the scope of human possibility, making the manifestation of sovereignists' imaginations in all their multifaceted forms seem feasible. streaming video, encrypted communications, and unstoppable money lets man bend space-time to his will. But attached to these advanced capabilities are new costs and risks. Lacking social safety nets and other government welfare programs will force individuals to become more self-responsible than they were accustomed to being in the agricultural and industrial ages, hereafter referred to as the analog ages. Successful sovereignists will be those who embody the timeless wisdom of Voltaire. With great power comes great responsibility. Voltaire. Sovereignists who rise to the occasion will no doubt be tested, as nation-states will fight back in an attempt to retain their traditional powers over populations. Nation-states will lose leverage over self-emancipated, sovereign individuals who will be armed with the tremendous optionality engendered by digital networks, markets, and capital. Increasingly desperate, targeted extortion may become the weapon of choice for failing governments. Only those sovereignists running the best OPSEC will survive such militaristic measures. As the reality of an existentially threatening digital future dawns on them, nation-states are unlikely to pull any punches in the subsequent power struggle. The sovereign individual describes it, quote, "Just as monarchs, lords, popes, and potentates fought ruthlessly to preserve their accustomed privileges in the early stages of the modern period, so today's governments will employ violence, often of a covert and arbitrary kind, in the attempt to hold back the clock. Weakened by the challenge from technology, the state will treat increasingly autonomous individuals, its former citizens, with the same range of ruthlessness and diplomacy it has heretofore displayed in its dealings with other governments." Strive as they might, nation-states will succumb to software. Fighting the free flow of data is as futile as fighting the tide. Bursting of the dams. In the digital age, the threats of physical violence that have been the alpha and the omega of politics since time immemorial will diminish. The sovereign individual. Nation-states, like dams, can only interrupt the inexorable flow of nature's self-organizing tendencies for so long. As taxing capacity plummets, diseconomies of scale will ensue, making smaller nation-states more economically competitive and therefore more attractive to sovereignists. Glimmers of this transition are already evident, with cities like Miami announcing programs to draw forward-thinking entrepreneurs into residency. Due to a variety of technological advances, the advantages of scale in a combat will be diminished. Thematically, digitization reduces the size that organizations must attain to be effective in the use of violence. Guns can be 3D printed. Cheap anti-aircraft drones can be launched. Hackers can cripple militaries. And capital can be mobilized without a trace. Asymmetries of cost and effect paradoxically result in more symmetrical power structures. When the cost of defense plummets, offensive strategies become less lucrative. In this re-decentralization of sovereignty, the world will undergo a reversion to a symmetry of violence last seen during the age of hunters and gatherers. However, this reversion will, somewhat counterintuitively, generate more peace on balance, since sometimes the power to take an action is more important than actually taking it. Similar to the ever-present threat of capital flight, forcing institutions to be more honest in their dealings, the ever-present threat of localized violence will encourage peaceful interaction among sovereigntists at scale. Armed with advanced weaponry enabling them to, quote, punch above their weight compared to nation-states, combat advantages will accrue to the most versatile and adaptive organizations. Equal access to armaments, downloadable in the digital space or buyable in unhampered markets, means sovereignists will mostly accord politely with one another. Although appealing at a civilizational level, achieving this symmetry of power involves a reconfiguration of institutional structures, an event likely to exhibit great turbulence, like nature restoring balance by bursting a dam. Greater symmetry of and reduced incentives for violence means less mass murders, less school shootings, and less government warmongering. However, sovereignists will still face threats like extortion and ransom, which nation-states may wield indiscriminately as they struggle to remain relevant while dissolving in a flood of digital acid. Demand for protection from failing governments will grow. OPSEC will be of paramount importance for anyone of means. Private security details are likely to become increasingly common among sovereignists. State-assigned identities will be abandoned and aliases adopted. As digital technology revolutionizes mankind in every respect, our laws will become antiquated, our institutions inverted, our morals reshaped, and our perceptions permanently altered. Sovereignism will shake the illusory sense of socioeconomic stability derived from violent monopolies and portend a total breakdown of the heavily politicized 20th century nation-state organizational model. As the sovereign individual words it, market forces, not political majorities, will compel societies to reconfigure themselves in ways that public opinion will neither comprehend nor welcome. As they do, the naive view that history is what people wish it to be will prove wildly misleading. A popular counter-argument to the rise of Bitcoin-enabled sovereignism is that nation-states will never allow it. Such a line of thought is inherently flawed, since it considers nation-states to be single, indivisible, and autonomous organizations. In truth, nation-states are more or less tightly interwoven constellations of individuals connected through common economic interests, trade networks, socio-cultural similarities, or geopolitical affiliations. Nation-states are not singular socio-economic aggregates, as the mental models of many dissenters falsely assume. The authority holding these outdated organizations together is, again, derived, either directly or indirectly, from their equity stake in the world's only analog sovereignty system, gold. As the level of service these nation-state complexes render declines relative to its cost, the incentives for individual citizens to exit these violently imposed monetary monopolies will increase commensurately, causing an eventual rush for the exits into Bitcoin. State police, judges, and regulators alike will face these pressures in their roles as citizens, and only the most stupid or jingoistic will ignore the economic pressures to exit failing fiat systems. As influential state constituents start acquiring Bitcoin, they become aligned with its success, and the power structures cohering every nation-state will be dissolved from the inside out. Self-sovereignty is in unceasing and universal demand on the free market. Bitcoin immutably speaks this truth to power. Sovereignism will see nation-state power structures stand naked before truth. Although this transition may seem alarming and potentially chaotic, the end game of sovereignism is an explosion of wealth and a commensurate human flourishing in the wake of nation-state dissolution. Self-organizing digital organizations stand to become the greatest testaments to Schumpeterian creative destruction known to history. The breaking of the nation-state dam, a complex of artifice, confiscation, and conscription, will unleash human ingenuity to a virtually incomprehensible extent. If this thesis holds true, history will regard the internet as merely a prerequisite innovation for Bitcoin, the real catalytic breakthrough in the civilizational conversion to sovereignism. Sovereignism will eclipse statism in the 21st century. This mega-political transition is already well underway, and its consequences are more evident by the day. In Part 2, we will examine Bitcoin as a catalyst to sovereignism, functioning as the ultimate offshore bank for 21st century sovereignists. Bitcoin is the key innovation in a world rapidly submerging into the ungovernable waters of the digital high seas. Thank you for reading Sovereignism Part 1, Digital Creative Destruction. The really amazing thing to me about the Sovereign Individual thesis, about the book itself, that really stuck with me and was eye-opening in trying to make sense of history, is that it showed how much technology shaped the world and the changes in our environment shaped the world, and how politics was really always just downwind. Is that the normal narrative that you're taught, in at least in public schools, is that who was president mattered, which war happened, was the underlying outcome of this or that century or whatever. Like, it's always who's in power, what was the political architecture of the time, who was running what, and who had to ask who for authority. But what's funny is that there was never an underlying cause for why one system worked during a time and another one worked, and it failed as time passed or as things changed, and why. There was no fundamental thesis that I had ever heard, at least, about what exactly it was at the heart of these very, very different systems. And you would argue that, oh, people didn't like them anymore or changed their minds and now we're going to do things this way. But we are a product of our environment. I say this a lot because this is something that we know about humans and we very, very seldom properly apply. It's one of those things where it's very easy to believe something that we've been taught about politics or technology or something, because it's just that surface layer status quo idea about those things. And then over on the other side, we know this very specific detail about what it fundamentally means to be human and what things impact who we are, how we think. And this just leads me kind of back to the thoughts in yesterday's episode that I didn't get to share with trust, is that paper money, debt, has such a profound impact on how we look at the world. That if you have a society that is perpetually in debt versus a society that's perpetually a little bit ahead on savings, that incentivizes savings and is based on a sound monetary standard versus one that's based on a paper and inflationary and money printing and debt incentivizing standard, you create a wholly different population. You create a wholly different culture of people. And the fact that the depression rates have been so high in Japan that they feel isolated, you know, if you're constantly in debt, you feel hopeless. You feel helpless. You feel like there's no chance, you have no control over your life. Like, that's the source of depression, right? Is that it's not merely that you see the negative in things. It's that you feel like you are in control of nothing, that you have no say over your life, and there's no light at the end of the tunnel. That changes who we are. That changes how we perceive the world around us, how we perceive other people. And to walk around the world, to have something like, and again, in the previous article, is Japan's debt to GDP was 260%. Everybody is just in debt. It's just debt all the way top to bottom. Is that you feel like you're walking through life with somebody else's hands around your throat. You're stuck in that crappy job because you have no leeway to make a stand. You become high preference. Your morals take a back seat. You have to constantly give up your integrity to keep your financial system from imploding. If you have to do something that you do not align with at your job, or your boss is mean to you, or just a horrible person, and you have no runway, if you get fired, that you're just screwed, you have to take the very next job that just happens to show up within the week, then your morals go out the window. Your integrity goes out the window. You feel like you just have to do that. You are a slave to them. It's because you are. John Adams said it. There are two ways to conquer and enslave a nation. One is by the sword, the other is by debt. Our environment the technology, the tools, the systems that we are a part of make up so much about who we are, what our culture is, and how we interact and see each other. Whether or not we are constantly at each other's throats, thinking that this other person is out to get me, or whether we cooperate, whether we are likely to build long-term relationships, these things matter. These things are fundamental. And the thing about the sovereign individual that really just kind of shook my whole view of history was that the dominant factor, the dominant tipping point in the different systems of monarchy and religious totalitarianism and feudalism and democracy and the industrialized nation state, the element that kept changing that caused one kind of political system to collapse and another one to rise in its place were the economics of violence. The reward versus cost of violently coercing another human being at scale. How hard is it to force thousands of people to do what you want? How hard is it to violently control the wealth and productivity that they produce? And in that book, they essentially argue, and with really strong foundation, that agriculture, the agricultural revolution, is actually what led to government in the first place. Because the only way to obtain wealth was geographically stuck. It was land. So it was very, very easy. And the amount of excess that was produced, it was very easy to steal 10% or 20% or 50% of what these people produced, who could not get up and leave. They were stuck. Their capital was stuck to where they lived. And so a violent state, a mafia that vowed to protect those people from another mafia, could make an astronomical return and confiscate an unbelievable amount of capital from this new capital accumulation technology. And specifically one that was stuck in place, that they could not go hide. They could not run away with it. It was stuck. You go back to the hunter and gatherer days, everybody carried all of their wealth on them. You could move around. There was no stuck somewhere. You just went where the food was. And government simply never arose. They couldn't. There was no, your quote-unquote population would be gone in no time. And there was no excess accumulated wealth to confiscate in the first place. There was no capital. And then suddenly you start looking at the rest of history, and they kind of like walk you through it in this book. And you see all of these other massive inventions, the longbow, and how it subsequently reshaped the world in the next century after its invention. Then gunpowder, the printing press, the industrial age, the internet, all of these things have profound impact on the cost and the reward of violence at scale. And the digital age turns the entire thing on its head, because the first time, understand, the cost of defense in the physical world has always been greater than the cost of offense. It's always 1,000 times more difficult to build a castle. It takes way more energy and way more order to build a massive castle than it does to tear the castle down. There has always been an economic asymmetry there. And part of the core philosophy of the cypherpunk ideal was the notion and the reality that cryptography flips that on its head. It's almost infinitely more difficult to attempt to brute force a cryptographic key than it is to create one and encrypt something. And it is so easy to hide and move around in the digital space, in cyberspace, that it's as if location doesn't exist at all. they likened it. The analogy that I always loved in the book was that they analogized it to why no one has ever actually dominated the oceans. The world's oceans have always basically been quote unquote international territory. And it's because there's no explicit border. There's nothing to put up a fence around. It's too fluid, you know, no pun intended. But there's no real way to put up a wall. Even an insanely expensive, quote-unquote, blockade is invariably unsuccessful. So despite all of the political tensions and all of the political desire, international waters remained international waters. And that's what they likened cyberspace to. The internet and the digital age is moving all of our economic activity and now directly our economic value into this digital ocean that has no walls, has no real fences, where blockades are entirely insubstantial, and where the cost to defend yourself is less than the cost of offense. Possibly for the first time in thousands of years, the cost-reward economics of violence at scale may literally have flipped on its head. And this is the power of Bitcoin. Is that Breedlove has a really great quote at the beginning of this, is that military rank, political affiliation, and proximity to the printing press as determinants of position in the global wealth hierarchy would be largely eliminated. He's talking about a thermodynamically sound money before he establishes, obviously, that we're talking about Bitcoin. But Bitcoin has no authority. It has no political system. And even if you are, like, the most politically important Bitcoin dev or the largest Bitcoin company, Bitcoin cannot and will not treat you any differently. It doesn't give two shits who you are. It will not bend for you. And considering the monopoly over money has become one of the greatest tools for the nation state to confiscate resources, because our ability to communicate quickly and instantly and all across the world is absolutely changing the dynamics of how much the nation state is actually able to confiscate without causing an uprising. This is why it is done through inflation, because inflation is invisible. It enables the reward without the people knowing how the theft is occurring. Rather than using violence, they use fraud. But I think it's pretty clear that the internet and the decentralization of communication is already really changing the dynamics of this game. The fact that we have all of this massive splintering of narratives across the country, but across the world. Trust in political institutions is as low as it's really ever been, it seems like. Or at least in the modern era, you know, going back 50, 70 years. And the technology continues to make it more and more obsolete, makes it more and more dangerous. You realize the cost of this huge system. Like, look at deepfakes. You know, so many people are like, you know, scared of deepfakes and talking about how this is terrible and awful and that, you know, this is super dangerous and, you know, what are we going to do about this? And you don't realize what it is that deepfakes are going to obsolete, where the risk and the cost of such a thing is going to exist. It is going to be explicitly in the cost of giant centralized systems that are great distances from the people they control. Is that I've never met Biden or Trump. I don't actually, none of us really know the first damn thing about either of those people. 99.9% of people's opinions and ideas of who those people are done through tiny little clips of video, audio, and a bunch of headlines. That's it. Our sliver of knowledge about the actual people and what goes on in the political sphere is tiny. in comparison to what is actually happening. The fact that those all of those items can be so easily lied about and faked makes the cost of keeping the center of power that far away and that huge and that centralized astronomical. What is the fallout of a video that has Biden saying something absolutely crazy or racist or talking about how we're going to bomb China or something just absolutely insane and other people believing it? Same thing with Trump, same thing with any politician. The cost isn't the danger of the deepfake. The cost is the danger of the power center that the deepfake could be used against. The costs and dangers of centralized power are getting greater and greater and greater as these new technologies come about. Whereas when you're looking at a localized level, when you break it down to the tiny places where you can actually go meet your mayor, where the people in your neighborhood you actually interact with, you may have had a conversation with the person, you could actually go get them to explain themselves. And it's very easy to tear down that power structure if somebody's an abusive, lying piece of crap. It's very close to you, and therefore it has the most accountability to the people in your local area. That is the solution to deepfakes. That is the solution to technology where it is so easy to fake anything we want and make it look real. Localize the centers of power so that the costs of an error or a lie are as small as they can possibly be while still having those institutions be viable. And again, we're not even talking about Bitcoin. We're just talking about the cost of a giant centralized system like this when nobody can know the truth. When nobody can discern the truth, there is too much information out there. Google is a literal confirmation bias machine. You can literally find evidence for any potential narrative you could ever want to find evidence for. And then at the same time, corruption is through the roof. So only a blind fool would actually trust the status quo, would actually trust the legacy institutions. So there's no source of truth anymore. There's none. It's all just an absolute dumpster fire. And Bitcoin is able to restore a totem of truth. It is a system of property rights and capital accumulation in which there are no rulers. That is not an insignificant technology when we are talking about the history of nation states and the economics of violence. The fact that you can memorize 12 words and walk naked into any jurisdiction on the planet and be carrying billions of dollars with you is not just a cool story, bro. It's a world-shattering new development in the economics of sovereignty. And I like Breedlove's term for it. You know, this is the agora, right? This is the agorist idea. Is that the beauty of markets and the power of markets is that they will outcompete the nation state. When the nation state takes over the economy, it is necessarily anti-market. This is always where states fail. They try to control the economy and prices and markets without realizing that the very nature of attempting to control them makes them not work. They only work because price signals are true. Because price signals are actually dependent on or actually adjust because of actual value and actual scarcity and actual supply within the market or within the respective economy. When they begin to react instead to fear of political violence, to political control, and to the subjective ideas of what reality is based on some political institution, then those systems break down, the prices break down, and fail to build the capital necessary to actually keep the state alive. The state has to be able to confiscate capital, which means if the system they are running isn't able to create capital because they're trying to control it too tightly, well, then the nation state dies because it's become so parasitic that it kills its own organism. The state cannot survive without the market producing price signals that allow the division of labor and the massive amount of economic output and capital accumulation that happens in a free market environment. This is why the USSR collapsed, right? Is the and that was one of the most really interesting things about that period in history, is that the black market became the legitimate market. They tried to, even the communist government would have no totem. They would have nothing to compare to in order to set prices within the government for when they were trying to produce, or to set the price of what things should be sold at, or how much should be built, or how much should be made of this product or this item. And what they would do is they would just leverage the U.S. market. They would just be like, all right, well, this is the price in the U.S. market, so this will be our price. The only reason it survived for as long as it did is because it just copied what the free market did and attempted to do it in a centralized manner. Again, without the free market, they never would have actually gotten anywhere. They would have failed out the gate. But eventually, the black market outproduced the legitimate market. It became the more productive economy, the more productive side of the economy, because it had real prices. And in the end, the market outcompeted the state. Now, obviously, this wasn't the end of the nation state. This was just an example of when the nation state becomes so parasitic that it kills its organism. But the very claim as to what the state is needed for in these, like, this day and age, the reason why the state must exist, is to enforce property rights. I hear it over and over and over again. Every time I'm arguing with a statist or somebody who, you know, thinks the state is inevitable or whatever, and, you know, usually there's some very interesting arguments, and I certainly don't claim that, you know, they're unthinking or that they're unable to take into account. And sometimes you have to admit, like, it seems like a crazy psycho pipe dream that the nation state could actually ever fall. Like, it's such a staple. I mean, the modern nation state, yes or no, but there's always been an institution of violence. Since the agricultural revolution, it's just been kind of the thing, right? It's been human organization. So I fully recognize the suggestion that that might actually implode and be unsustainable in the not too distant future is insane. It sounds crazy. But if you really look at history from the context of the economics of violence at scale, suddenly it becomes a lot more plausible than you might first assume. And if the state's sole responsibility truly is to suggest that property rights can't exist without them, that they are the reason property rights exist, a system like Bitcoin isn't just disruptive, it is literally revolutionary. There is nobody protecting my Bitcoin but me. There is no hierarchy. There is no authority. Bitcoin defines the rules, and those rules are impenetrable regardless of the amount of violence. Now, the $5 wrench attack always exists, right? But this is something that occurs on an individual level. This is not something that is done easily at scale. And most importantly, is a very, very subtle but critical change in the dynamic. For as long as you can look back in the history of the state and government and mafias and all of these things, they used violence, and they could come in and they could take your wealth from you. But with Bitcoin, they have to force you to give it to them. They can't take it. They need to hurt you so that you will give it, because that is the only way to have it change hands. It is property rights in the digital age, and it is the best, easiest to secure, easiest to keep private property rights as we have ever had. And it exists in every jurisdiction on the planet. And that is incredibly crazy to think about. Whatever the consequences of this thing are, they are not small. And Breedlove is, I'm a huge fan of the sovereign individual and this idea of sovereignism. He's already got part two out. I don't think he's got part three yet. I haven't actually checked And sorry, this one took me forever to finally get done. A really great piece, and I'm excited to dig into this series. Hopefully we'll be able to do this whole thing. I know it's probably hard to read it, because Breedlove is always long-winded. So hopefully Bitcoin Audible can help get this whole series in audio, and we'll stay on top of it. And thank you to Swan Bitcoin, both for sponsoring the show, but also for running this, for doing this series, for publishing this, and having this hosted on Swan Bitcoin blog. And I really like Breedlove's thoughts on this towards the end when he talks about how to think about the state is that, and actually, you know what, we'll get to it in just a second. Let me thank my sponsor, my other sponsor. Thank you to Swan Bitcoin, obviously, swanbitcoin.com/guy for your automatic Bitcoin savings account. It is the best, only, it's the only way to stack sats reliably. Just do it automatically. SwanBitcoin.com/guy. And of course, do it to a secure open source hardware wallet like the Bitbox O2. I love these guys over at Shift Crypto, and I love this device. Got to check out the Bitbox. It's just easy to use, and it's a great tool. GuySwan2ends.com/Bitbox. Okay, so before we close this out, though, there was a comment or a framing that Breedlove got into at the end of this that I thought was so cool is that when you're thinking about the economics of the individual, when you're thinking about the violence payoff of the individual versus a vast institution of violence and the economic payoff, you realize that the idea of thinking of the nation state as a single-minded cohesive apparatus is flawed, because the very nature, the very reason the individual economics, the payoff of violence at scale changes so drastically is because the state is simply a giant group of individuals. And he says, there's a quote towards the end that says, state police, judges, and regulators alike will face these pressures in their roles as citizens, and only the most stupid or jingoistic will ignore the economic pressures to exit the failing fiat systems. As influential state constituents start acquiring Bitcoin, they become aligned with its success, and the power structures cohering every nation state will be dissolved from the inside out. The very existence of Bitcoin and the ability to have an exit door from that organizational structure will have its very cells, the people within the state apparatus, will start to fall away from supporting the apparatus. And again, this is all unfolding when the state is in flux in every possible way. It's got a battle on every single front that we can imagine. And Breedlove is right. It probably will get violent. It's an institution of violence. What else does it know to do? And unfortunately, my OPSEC is pretty screwed. So is Breedlove's. But in my opinion, there's no better future to bet on. Like, the market is going to win out. Like I've said, the Bitcoin economy is going to be 1,000 times more robust. It's going to be stronger. It's going to be over-collateralized. It's going to have real prices. And it is going to outproduce the shit of the legacy system. The legacy system is stagnant, wasteful, inefficient, and unproductive. And it is because all of its prices are a lie. Bitcoin's price never lies. It reacts in huge shocks as quick as possible to any change in the sentiment, in the reality of the situation, in the change in the supply, in a change to the liquidity. Bitcoin has real prices, and the market that develops on top of it will be robust, over-collateralized, and unbelievably productive. No one will be wasting sats on bullshit. They will be building things that matter. And I absolutely love that. I've been seeing a wave of people on Twitter who have been quitting their legacy jobs and rushing to try to find Bitcoin jobs. And all the best Bitcoin companies are literally just buying up Twitter Bitcoiners to work on their teams. And We have a whole economy of people who are passionate about changing the freaking world, and they are all building the exact tools that everybody needs and wants to get us over that bridge. I am bullish. And if the other side of that bridge brings sovereignism, then holy crap, the world, I know Bitcoin's going to change the world, but we still don't know by how much and exactly in what way. I guess all we can do is keep discovering and keep thinking about it and build toward the future we want. So with that, this is Bitcoin Audible. I'm Guy Swan. Don't forget to subscribe, and thank you so much for listening. Until next time, guys, take it easy. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.